When I first heard what happened to Farkhunda, I couldn't believe my ears. How could a crowd of ordinary people living among us commit such a brutal act? But what shocked me even more was how so many tried to justify it. She brought it on herself, they said. She insulted the faith. But is that really what faith is about? Can justice be delivered with fists and stones? Honestly, guys, this story still gives me chills, so let's dive right into this difficult case. This story isn't just about Farkhunda. It's about how, in our society, women constantly have to prove their innocence simply by existing. While some may try to forget what happened, we have to remember, so such injustice never happens again. March 2015 in Kabul. The city was buzzing with preparations for Nowruz, the Persian New Year, celebrated in Afghanistan on March 21st or 22. Farkhunda Malikzada, like her entire family, was getting ready for the big day. Her faith, which had guided her since childhood, was at the center of her life. But this very faith and her deep religiosity would shape the events that would ultimately change her life forever. Thursday, March 19th, Farkhunda left her home as usual, fully intending to attend her Quran studies. Before she left, she spent a few peaceful moments with her family. She kissed her little nephew, shared kind words with her mother, and promised she'd be back soon. That day, the house was filled with the aroma of spices, a familiar scent thanks to Farkhunda's culinary skills. She was a true master in the kitchen. She had taken on most of the responsibility for preparing the holiday meal, and with a smile, she assured her family everything would be ready on time. However, her path that day didn't take her directly to her lesson. Instead, she stopped at one of her favorite spots, the Shado Shamshira Mosque, a majestic building with soft yellow walls standing near the Kabul River. Farkhunda always found peace and calm there. Her visits to the mosque had become a ritual, and it was here she often met with the elderly caretaker, Zainuddin. He was a wise and kind man, always willing to engage in discussions about religion and share his knowledge. With him, Farkhunda could talk about Quranic verses that were important to her, and Zainuddin saw in her the purity and sincerity of her faith. Their conversations under the mosque's arches not only strengthened her spirit, but also brought her a sense of tranquility. Her devotion to her religious beliefs was unwavering. From a young age, she had absorbed the lessons of discipline and modesty instilled by her parents. The Quran wasn't just a holy book to her, it was a source of inspiration and strength. She had memorized its verses and could recite passages that gave her confidence during the toughest moments in life. This piety was also reflected in her appearance, always modest, never showing her hair or body, except for the oval of her face and her hands. Despite her commitment to family and faith, Farkhunda's personal life hadn't unfolded as she had hoped. Her dreams of marriage and children hadn't come true. Marriage proposals, which she quietly longed for, never materialized. She held on to hope, though at times she couldn't help but wonder why fate hadn't smiled upon her in this regard. Her family reassured her that things would happen in due time, but the anxiety still lingered inside her. With each passing year, her devotion to her faith became even more evident. Those around her didn't just see her as a young woman, they saw her as a symbol of ideals many believed had been lost in the modern world. Friends, teachers, and acquaintances respected her. To them, she was an example of sincerity, virtue, and spirituality. That March day when Farkhunda left home, everything seemed as normal as ever, but this day would mark a turning point in her life. The events that would unfold at the gates of Shado Shamshira Mosque would change her fate forever, along with the lives of those who knew and loved her. Farkhunda couldn't walk past Zainuddin's stall without noticing the bright scarves, sparkling beads, and especially the neatly arranged amulets. Approaching closer, she picked one up and immediately noticed strange symbols on the rolled-up papers inside. Her heart began to race. These markings clearly went against the teachings of Islam. How could anyone sell such items right outside a mosque where people came seeking spiritual enlightenment? Unable to hide her shock and outrage, she approached Zainuddin with a question. The old man, noticing her interest, slowly raised his eyes and with a slight smirk, responded that he sold what people wanted. "Many believe in their power and are willing to pay for it," he said indifferently. But Farkhunda couldn't accept such an explanation. She tried to convince him that such things contradicted the Quran, that these weren't just amulets, but a desecration of sacred texts. The tension between them grew with every word. Holding the cold beads of one of the amulets in her hand, she carefully unwrapped the paper inside. It contained a small fragment of the Quran, but the verses were taken out of context, surrounded by symbols that resembled magical signs. Farkunda felt a wave of indignation and fear. For her, this wasn't just disrespect, it was blasphemy, turning the sacred into a tool for deceit. Zainuddin, noticing her reaction, began speaking more confidently. His tone softened, as if telling a bedtime story. "These amulets can work miracles," he began. "They can heal illnesses, bring luck, protect from evil. And if a woman wants children, this amulet will guarantee her the pregnancy she's been hoping for." Farkunda couldn't believe what she was hearing. How could someone so calmly and with such certainty peddle false promises as if they were the truth? But that wasn't all. Her eyes were drawn to other items on the stall, things that seemed entirely out of place in a sacred setting. Alongside the amulets and beads were packs of pills, and among them, Farkunda noticed Viagra and condoms. To her, this was the epitome of cynicism and an insult to the traditions she held so dear. Her outrage grew stronger. Unable to contain herself, she began speaking louder, her voice ringing with righteous anger. She accused Zainuddin of blasphemy, telling him that his trade was an insult to the faith and that he was deceiving simple, devout people. She demanded that he remove his goods immediately and close his stall. Their argument grew more heated, and soon their raised voices began drawing the attention of passersby. People started to stop, forming a circle around them, as if watching a scene unfold. Zainuddin, now losing his composure, his voice trembling with tension, suddenly shouted to the crowd, "This woman burned a copy of the Quran!" His words struck like lightning, shocking the bystanders. Their faces instantly twisted in horror and judgment. Farkunda, keeping her calm, loudly and clearly stated, "I am a Muslim, and Muslims do not burn the Quran." But her words were drowned out by the rising tide of outrage. The rumor of her desecration spread like wildfire. The crowd became more and more enraged, and men began streaming toward the Shado Shamshira Mosque, their faces filled with righteous fury, ready to avenge the alleged insult to the holy text. In footage captured by witnesses, you can see the crowd of men surrounding Farkunda, whose desperate attempts to defend herself were swallowed by the hateful shouts. Her voice echoed above the growing chaos as she denied the accusations, but her words were lost in the aggression. She repeated over and over that she had not burned the Quran, that she was a Muslim, but no one was listening. Cries of "Silence!" rang out, and her only chance to be heard vanished under the weight of collective rage. The atmosphere grew darker by the second. Farkunda pleaded with the crowd, asking them to stop filming her on their phones, but the mob, consumed by fury, paid no attention. A push, and she fell to the ground. Seconds felt like hours as the men, now encircling her, began raining down blows. Countless feet and fists struck her, leaving her no chance to rise or defend herself. Her screams pierced the air, but in the roar of hatred, no one heard them anymore. When the police finally arrived, for a moment, it seemed like there was a chance to stop the crowd. Shots fired into the air briefly slowed the violence, causing some men to back away. Farkunda, sitting on the cold pavement, tried to shield herself from the blows, covering her face with her hands. Her disheveled hair hung down and her chador, knocked from her head, lay on the ground beside her. An officer reached out to her, offering to help her up and take her to the station. But despite her pain and humiliation, she refused, demanding that a female officer escort her, unwilling to let any man touch her. Meanwhile, the crowd did not calm down. People continued to gather, shouting curses and accusations. Some filmed the entire scene on their phones, spreading the hatred across the city. At some point, as if by an unseen signal, the mob reached a decision. For the alleged desecration of the holy book, Farkunda had to die. The crowd's rage hit its peak, and the madness could no longer be stopped. Around 150 men surrounded Farkunda, 150 against one woman. The mob, consumed by a thirst for blood, stormed the mosque, screaming and threatening, as if driven purely by hate. The police, realizing they had lost control of the situation, merely watched, too afraid to intervene. Farkunda was grabbed and dragged onto the roof of the mosque. Her screams echoed through the building, but no one listened, No one came to her aid. They threw her off the roof. The following moments turned into a nightmare. Farkunda's helpless body, stripped of any defense, became the target of unrelenting hatred from those who believed they had the right to enact their own justice. They continued to beat her even after life had left her body. This all happened in front of dozens of onlookers, yet not a single person stepped forward to stop the brutality. Meanwhile, just a few miles from the scene of the tragedy, Farkunda's home was filled with peaceful, everyday routines. Her parents were preparing for the holiday, expecting their daughter's return. They went about their familiar tasks, her mother sorting through fabrics, planning to refresh the carpets they had woven together, her father thinking over the menu for the festive table. Farkunda's brother played carefree with his nephew, unaware that their comfort and tranquility were about to be shattered. They couldn't have imagined that something so horrific was happening to their daughter. In their minds, the morning was still fresh. Farkunda had left the house with a smile, kissing each of them goodbye and promising to return in a few hours. The hours passed, and Farkunda's family remained unaware of the horrors unfolding on the streets of Kabul. At around 4 p.m., Farkunda's father's phone rang, breaking the quiet, peaceful atmosphere in the house. Seeing his daughter's name on the screen, he answered, mildly surprised, expecting to hear her familiar voice. But instead of a warm greeting, a harsh, unfamiliar voice came through. "Come to Shah Doshamshira Mosque immediately," the stranger said, and the line went dead. His heart tightened with a sense of dread. He didn't know what had happened, but something inside told him it was serious. He called for his wife and son, told them about the call, and they quickly rushed to the meeting place. As they approached the mosque, they were met with a horrifying sight. The crowd surrounding the building seemed endless. People were shouting words filled with anger and condemnation, some cursing, others with fear and confusion in their eyes. Chaos reigned. The family couldn't comprehend what was happening. Their hearts pounded in sync with the rising noise of the mob, but no answers came. Fear grew inside them, gnawing at their souls, but they still didn't know that at that very moment they had already lost their daughter. As they pushed their way through the crowd, trembling with tension, a police officer approached them. He looked at them seriously and asked them to follow him. Confused and gripped by fear, they complied, hoping to finally receive some explanation. At the police station, investigators greeted them. They informed the family that an incident had occurred involving Farkunda, and in order to avoid further complications, they needed to sign some documents. The investigators hinted that if the parents agreed to confirm that their daughter had mental health issues, the whole situation could be quickly swept under the rug. But Farkunda's father, understanding the implications, firmly refused. His refusal sparked dissatisfaction among the police. He knew his daughter was perfectly healthy and wasn't about to lie. Her mother, sobbing, also refused to sign the papers. This moment marked a turning point. A heavy silence followed, broken only when one of the investigators, with a cold, indifferent voice, delivered the news no parent ever expects to hear. Their daughter was dead. It was like a thunderclap on a clear day, words too unimaginable to process. Farkunda's mother looked at the police in horror, unable to believe what she'd just heard. Her legs gave out and she collapsed to her knees, sobbing and begging for it all to be a mistake. Her father, stunned by the news, stood frozen, unable to move. Farkunda's brother, paralyzed with shock, stared at the officers, his face contorted with a mix of anger and disbelief, searching for even a flicker of compassion in their eyes. Soon, they had to go to the morgue to identify their daughter's body. The cold, sterile room greeted them with an eerie silence. Shaking, Farkunda's mother approached the plastic bag and slowly unzipped it. Inside lay the mutilated body of her daughter, covered in burns and the marks of brutal violence. Gently, she ran her hand over Farkunda's face, as if trying to wipe away the pain and suffering she had endured. Tears streamed down her cheeks as she quietly whispered, "Why? Why did this happen to you, my dear?" In her grief, she felt as though Farkunda was answering her in a silent whisper, asserting her innocence. Realizing the gravity of the situation, the Afghan authorities ordered Farkunda's family to leave Kabul immediately for their own safety. With no other choice, her parents and brother packed their belongings and fled, leaving behind their home and the life they once knew. All they could take with them was the unbearable pain of loss and the bitter taste of injustice. The world learned of their tragedy within hours. Videos of the brutal killing began circulating on social media. The men who had participated in the lynching showed no shame. Instead, they proudly posted photos, boasting of their actions. Some even publicly justified the crime, calling it just punishment. The next day, a new wave of unrest swept through Kabul. Some high-ranking officials and religious leaders were quick to justify the mob's actions, claiming that the protection of the Quran justified any means. Their words were cold and cruel, without a hint of regret. However, Afghanistan's president, Ashraf Ghani, was the only one to condemn the horrific act, calling it a national disgrace. He demanded an immediate investigation to bring those responsible to justice. Kabul's investigative authorities reviewed all available data and witness statements within hours. It soon became clear there was not a shred of evidence that Farkhunda had burned the Quran or collaborated with foreigners. Her death was the result of a false accusation and a mob's uncontrollable rage. Officials who had initially supported the lynching began retracting their statements, but their reputations were already tarnished. Most were later removed from their positions, and their careers were in ruins. Despite their grief and fear, Farkhunda's family returned to Kabul to give her a proper farewell. The funeral took place on March 22nd, 3 days after the tragedy. The crowd at the funeral was as large as the one that had killed her, but this time, people came not with hatred, but with sorrow and shame. Afghan women took on an unusual role. They carried Farkhunda's coffin, defying the tradition that reserved this task for men. When some men offered to help, the women angrily waved them off, shouting, "Where were you when 150 men attacked Farkhunda? Where were you then?" On March 24th, 2 days after the funeral, thousands of women took to the streets of Kabul. They held signs that read, "We are all Farkhunda," and their faces were painted with red, symbolizing blood. It was a protest against injustice, a cry for change that Afghan women had long been waiting for. In their chants, they demanded respect and the rights they had always been denied. This was more than a call to action. It was a symbol of unity and unshakable resolve. The protest wasn't just women. It also included men walking alongside their wives, sisters, and mothers. They carried signs of support and solidarity. It was one of the largest and most significant civil demonstrations Afghanistan had seen in years. Many of the participants believed this could mark the beginning of a new era, a time when women's rights would be protected and violence would come to an end. After the brutal crime against Farkhunda shocked the country and the world, 49 men were arrested. But during the investigation, it became clear that these weren't extremists or radical fanatics. They were ordinary people, men of different ages and professions. They looked like typical city dwellers, wearing jeans, t-shirts, and sports jackets. They didn't look like the kind of people capable of such cruelty, but that's exactly what made Farkhunda's case so terrifying. One high-ranking official bitterly noted, "They put on jeans and t-shirts, but their hatred for women hasn't changed." At first, there was silence. Kabul went on with its usual routines when what seemed like a small event escalated into a tragedy. A few weeks after it happened, the entire world was watching the trial, which was supposed to be a landmark case for Afghanistan. The country held its breath, watching live broadcasts. People hoped that those responsible for the crime against Farkhunda would be brought to justice, but those hopes quickly turned to disappointment. On May 5, 2015, the verdicts were announced. Of the 49 men, 26 were acquitted. This caused outrage among those following the trial. How could nearly half of the participants be cleared of charges? There was even more anger when it was revealed that 11 police officers, who had stood by and done nothing, were given only 1 year in prison. The hope for justice collapsed. How could 1 year compare to the life they failed to protect? Out of the entire mob, only 8 civilians were sentenced to 16 years, and just 4 men were given the death penalty. Among them was Zainuddin, the mosque caretaker, the very man who had first accused Farkhunda. He, as an elder, saw himself as a defender of faith, but his true motives remained a mystery. Questions arose. Why did he accuse her? Was it purely religious fanaticism, or was there something personal driving him? Among those convicted was a young man named Yaqub. He was only 16, and his involvement in the crime shocked many. Up until that day, he had lived a normal life, working in his uncle's shop, dreaming of his future. Hearing the commotion in the street, he ran out to see what was happening, and before he knew it, he had become part of a violent mob. In videos that spread across the internet, his face was captured at the moment he picked up a large stone and threw it at Farkunda. A boy who once dreamed of becoming an athlete had, in an instant, turned into a criminal. This act left a deep scar on his family. Yakub's parents couldn't believe that their son had been capable of such cruelty. They were in shock, but as the reality sank in, they admitted that their son had shown complete disrespect to a woman he didn't even know. Despite all the evidence, the sentences were unexpectedly reduced. On July 2, 2015, in a closed session of the appeals court, the death penalties were overturned. Three men were given 20 years in prison, and Yakub, just 10 years. This sparked a new wave of protests. People had expected justice, but instead they were met with leniency toward those who had committed a horrific crime. How could this happen? Why were those who took on the role of judge and executioner given such light punishment? What was even more outrageous was that the 11 police officers, previously sentenced to just 1 year, were soon released on bail. Four of them even returned to their positions in the Ministry of Interior. This only fueled the public's anger. Kabul's streets were filled with outrage. People couldn't understand how those who had stood by and done nothing were allowed to resume their roles. Meanwhile, Afghanistan's First Lady, Rula Ghani, openly expressed her dismay and pain over what had happened. She couldn't comprehend how society had allowed such brutality. "This is a sign that our country has lived in an atmosphere of violence for far too long," she said. Her words resonated with thousands of Afghans who could no longer remain silent. Farkunda's family, who had been forced to leave Kabul immediately after the tragedy, returned to say goodbye to their daughter, but they already knew that justice had been fleeting. The trial had become a reflection of the state of the nation. Dreams of equality and fairness once again clashed with a reality where women remained vulnerable to violence. This case left a lasting scar on Afghanistan's history, but the question of whether true change would come remained unanswered. They stood under a gray sky, gathered on the banks of the Kabul River. It seemed as if everything in this place was soaked in grief, and the heavy, oppressive sky silently watched over them. Farkunda's memorial towered above the river, a black marble slab engraved with the words, "Martyr, innocent, unforgotten." The body of the young woman, whose name was now known across the country, had been burned here on this very spot, and this place had become a symbol of her suffering and of the fact that women in Afghanistan still lived in a world where injustice was the norm. People came to the memorial every day. Some left flowers, others simply stood in silence. But for many, especially women, this place was more than just a reminder. It was a place of anger. Anger at the system, at the culture, at the laws that still left them powerless. "The government has shown its weakness again," some whispered. "Farkunda wasn't the first, and I fear she won't be the last," others declared. Their voices were lost in the air, but the words sounded like accusations, accusations that no one had protected her. How could they let the mob kill her so brutally, without even asking if she was guilty? A year had passed since Farkunda Malikzada was killed. On March 23, 2016, a memorial was unveiled in Kabul in her honor. Her body had been burned at this very spot, and now a monument stood there, a reminder of the injustice that everyone saw, yet everyone ignored. The memorial was built for those who wanted to remember. But memory alone doesn't change the system. At the memorial's opening, activists took to the stage. "We know the government will do nothing for women," they said. The crowd nodded. They were right, and everyone knew it. Farkunda's death wasn't an exception. Farkunda's death was the rule. "We continue to live in hell," they continued, and no one disagreed. Even the street where the tragedy occurred was renamed. It now bore Farkunda's name. For some, it symbolized her suffering. For others, it was a constant reminder that real change would never come. This street had become a symbol, not of transformation, but of time standing still, where every day brings the same problems all over again. Meanwhile, Shado Shamshira Mosque, where it all began, had changed. The new caretaker, Haji Naim, decided to restore order. His rules were strict. No wandering around the mosque grounds, no cell phones allowed. He was firm. The mosque should be a place for prayer, not a playground for distractions. But his words echoed the past. After all, it was on these very grounds that people not only forgot how to pray, they forgot what it meant to be human. Today we look more through cameras than through our own eyes, he continued. When someone falls, we record it instead of helping. His rules caused some frustration, but no one denied that they were necessary. After all, too many victims had fallen under the lenses of cell phones. But while the mosque's rules changed, nothing improved for women. Since Farkunda's tragic death, the atmosphere in the country had only gotten worse. Women became even more vulnerable, while men grew bolder. On social media, Afghan women shared their stories. Stories about how men in workplaces and universities became even more brazen, knowing there would likely be no consequences for their actions. Now they think they can get away with anything, one woman wrote on Facebook. They say we're the ones provoking the violence. What was even more disturbing was that many men started blaming Farkunda herself for her death. In videos circulating online, they claimed she was dressed inappropriately. Even though she had only lost her headscarf while being brutally beaten, it became an excuse for condemnation. She brought it on herself, they said. And these words weren't just an accusation. They became a symbol of how easily the blame could be shifted onto the victim. It was horrifying. It wasn't just a step backward. It was proof that real change wasn't coming. Afghan society still viewed women as those who break the rules. And Farkunda's death, instead of being a call for change, became yet another reason for men to blame women for the country's problems. But amid this darkness, there were also voices of resistance. Activists who refused to stay silent gathered at protests. We won't stop, they declared. We will fight for every person who's been lost, for every woman that society has rejected. These words were bold, but they knew the road ahead would be long. Farkunda's tragedy must be a lesson, they repeated, hoping someone would listen. The memorial, the renamed street, the new rules at the mosque, all were attempts to spark change. But change hadn't come. The fear for their own lives remained for Afghan women, many of them still worried about their safety. The memorial became a symbol of remembrance, but it didn't change the reality. Every woman who walked past the memorial knew this could happen to any of us. So when I look at Farkunda's story, I can't help but wonder, what really needs to change for these kinds of tragedies to stop happening? Monuments? Renamed streets? These are all symbols, but they don't solve the problem. The problem runs deeper in how our society treats women, how easily it blames and rejects them. Farkunda's story isn't just the story of one brutal day. It's a lesson for all of us. And if we don't fight for change, if we don't start speaking up boldly about women's rights and protection, there will be more stories like this. I hope this lesson won't be forgotten, because silence always breeds new tragedies.